This is the LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Richard Phillips and Mike Eisenberg on the Dodd-Frank Act. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. Dick Phillips is a senior partner at K&L Gates. He concentrates his practice in securities regulation, particularly investment management, broker-dealer, and SEC enforcement. Mike Eisenberg is the former acting director, SEC Division of Investment Management, and SEC Deputy General Counsel. Since 2006, he's been a visiting professor at Willamette University College of Law, teaching courses on securities regulation, and is a senior research scholar and lecturer in law at Columbia University School of Law.
Good morning. Our program this morning is focused on the regulation of private fund advisors under the services reform legislation, the Dodd-Frank Act. We will focus on the impact of the legislation on private fund advisors. My name is Richard Phillips. I'm a partner of K&L Gates in San Francisco. With me this morning is Mike Eisenberg, who is a former acting director of the SEC's Division of Investment Regulation and a member of the faculty of both Columbia University Law School and Willamette University Law School. I'll start with an overview of the legislation as it affects private fund advisors, and Mike will go into much more detail on the impact of the legislation on private fund advisors. The legislation, the Dodd-Frank bill, would dramatically alter the scope of required federal investment advisor registration under the Advisors Act of 1940. It would affect not only private fund advisors, but also other advisors that might be required to register under the Act as presently drafted. First, the Act would remove the private advisor exception for less than 15 clients, which has been in the Act since 1940. And many private advisors have relied on this exemption to remain unregistered. It would, however, create a host of new exemptions from registration, including limited exemptions for private advisors who are organized outside the United States, foreign private advisors, advisors solely to private funds with assets of less than $150 million, advisors solely to venture capital funds, but there are certain new record-keeping and filing requirements as adopted by the SEC, which would be applicable to them, advisors to SBICs, so-called family offices, an entirely new concept under the Act, and commodity trading advisors. It would also increase the minimum assets under management for federal registration from $25 to $100 million, provided that the advisors with $100 million in assets or under are subject to registration and examination by the states. Interestingly, it would impose new record-keeping and filing requirements on registered advisors to private funds, and of course subject them to new SEC examination requirements, which is probably the most important part of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. The record-keeping and filing requirements have provisions that subject them to confidentiality and exempt them from public disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. The confidentiality requirements do not apply if the operations of the advisors create systemic risk in the view of the regulators. And, of course, they don't apply to request to disclosures to Congress and disclosures in connection with any kind of enforcement or legal proceeding. The legislation will have an impact far beyond private funds and advisors to private funds, because it changes and provides the mechanism for further changes in the class of persons who can be qualified for a so-called private offering under the Securities Act and the Investment Company Act. and Reg D thereunder. First, and significant for investors who live in California and other jurisdictions where housing prices are relatively high, in calculating a natural person's net worth for purposes of the accredited investor standard, one must now exclude the value of the person's primary residence. So, for example, under the present accredited investor standard, there's $1 million minimum net worth necessary to qualify as a hedge fund or other private fund advisor. That $1 million must now be calculated by excluding the value of the residence. Secondly, the SEC is permitted, not required, but permitted, initially to review the natural person accredited investor standard, other than the net worth test, and adjust it, increase it if they think it's justified. And after 4 years, they can do it for the entire set of qualifications, including the net worth qualifications. Secondly, for qualified clients which under the Investment Advisors Act can be charged a performance fee, the SEC is required, not just permitted, to adjust the standards no later than 4 years after enactment of the bill and every 4 years thereafter. Significantly, there is no change and no ability of the SEC to change the qualified purchaser standard of Section 3C7 under the Advisors Act, which permits a so-called private offering to an unlimited amount of investors. That standard, which requires generally a minimum of $5 million in investments, is unchanged, and there's no authority vested in the SEC to make any change in the future. Significantly also, the Act places limitations under the so-called Volcker Rule on the ability of U.S. and certain non-U.S. financial institutions that are regulated by the Federal Reserve Board to sponsor or invest in hedge funds or private equity funds. And there's also authority in a new Financial Stability Oversight Council, consisting of the heads of the financial industry regulators, to also set additional limitations if the firms are large enough to pose a systemic risk. These limitations under the so-called Volcker Rule are very significant for banking institutions. They basically say that a banking entity can only sponsor or offer hedge funds and private equity funds to their bona fide fiduciary, trust, and investment advisor clients. They can't guarantee results, and they have to disclose that the bank does not bear any of the risk of an investment. The funds cannot have a similar name to the banking entity, and there can be no ownership by bank directors or employees except those directly involved in managing the private fund, which, is, as I said, is limited to clients of the bank in a fiduciary, trust, or investment advisory capacity. Significantly also, bank can only have de minimis investment interest in a hedge fund or private equity fund. They can, for their own sponsored funds, have seed investments for up to 100% of the seed investment amount for 1 year, and after 1 year, they cannot have more than a 3% interest in the sponsored hedge funds. They can't lend money to the hedge funds, and there are other restrictions on transactions with the sponsored hedge fund. There are a number of studies also authorized or required by the Act. There's a study by the GEO that's authorized and required for accredited investor qualifications, which could significantly affect the eligibility of persons to invest in private funds. There is significantly also a GAO-mandated study of the feasibility of organizing a self-regulatory organization for private funds. And then there's a third study that talks about the compliance costs of SEC custody rules. And one of the provisions in the legislation, which we haven't mentioned, which I call the Madoff rule, would permit the SEC to write rules dealing with custody and public accountants for private funds, could be a very important provision. These are the highlights of the legislation. It's enormously complicated, even if limited to private funds. To get into some of the complications in the application of the registration provisions, I turn the program over to Mike Eisenberg.
Well, thank you, Dick. I think that the most important thing, of course, is that the significant change and the impact of this legislation. Just to start, recapitulate just a little bit of what Dick said, just to lay out that it removes the private advisor exemption under 203B3, which used to be relied upon, and it creates instead a whole bunch of new exemptions. So the new exemptions replace 203B3. Now, so unless you qualify for an exemption, you're going to register, which means a lot of people are going to have to register that did not have to register before. And among those who do have to register or would have to register, if they're under a certain amount, that $100 million in assets, then there is a division of authority, and the commission, the SEC, would cede jurisdiction to the states, assuming that the states have the legislative authority in their own states to register these companies.
In believing that if a investment advisor has one client that with assets over $100 million
right.
is required to register as an investment advisor under the Advisors Act.
That's right.
That's another exemption.
That's an example of the significant overhaul, which is fairly pervasive. Now, so the question then becomes, okay, what are these exemptions? And Dick listed them, and listing them briefly, an introduction, there are exemptions for foreign private advisors, advisors solely to private funds if they have assets of under management in the U.S. of less than $150 million, advisors to venture capital funds, advisor to business investment companies, and this family offices business. Also advisors to registered CFTC, CTAs. Now, the advisors with...
It's an interesting commentary that private equity funds are not exempt, but venture capital and SBICs are exempt, subject to some record-keeping and filing requirements.
Each of these exemptions has interpretive questions which have yet to be filled out by commission guidance. Not only does the commission have rule writing that they have to go through in order to clarify this, but there will be interpretive matters also. And what Dick just hit on, well, what's a venture capital fund? Well, the normal definition of a venture capital fund is you take over a company. Well, but there are these sort of hybrids which are termed venture capital funds, which don't do that, or which invest...
You mean private equity funds take over companies.
That's right. And... I'm sorry, the private equity fund. So the questions of definitions of who is what are not all that clear. The Act contains a provision that also importantly shifts the regulatory burden of monitoring the smaller advisors to the states so that the SEC can focus on the larger investment advisors. And most of this is effective 1 year after enactment of the statute. The minimum assets under management threshold for the commission for most of the U.S. advisors are $100 million in general, but $25 million for advisors that would either not be subject to registration and examination in the state in which they maintain their principal offices and places of business, or if they would be required to register in 15 states or more. Bottom line, advisors with more than $100 million in assets under management probably not going to be affected by the reallocation of the federal state authority, but require many investment advisors with assets between $25 and $100 million that are currently registered with the SEC to withdraw their SEC registrations and instead register in their home state and potentially other states in which they have clients. So that dichotomy of people with over $150 million, these are the bases upon which these exemptions proceed. Now, the private advisor exemption. Basically, the Dodd-Frank Act provides an exemption for registration of advisors for any foreign private advisors, which means an advisor that hasn't got a place of business in the U.S., has a total of fewer than 15 clients and investors in the U.S., in private funds advised by the investment advisor, has aggregate assets under management attributable to clients in the United States, and investors in the United States in private funds advised by the investment advisor of less than $25 million. Or the SEC apparently has flexibility to raise that level.
I understand, Mike, that that you count as a investor each investor in any private fund. So you look through the private funds.
That's right. And that was not done before. And in terms of what this does is, even if you are one of the conditions of the exemptions, even if you don't have to register, you have to keep records, as Dick pointed out. Well, those records are fairly complicated in terms of there are certain things that you have to keep records about, even if you're not registered. You have to keep a record of, well, obviously, the amount of assets under management and the use of leverage, including off-balance sheet leverage, the counterparty credit risk exposure, the trading and investment positions, valuation policies and practices, which becomes very important, and the controversy about what is an appropriate value and who represents the value, and given the accounting discussions that are going on now, hopefully will help settle some of that. That's especially important for pension funds, for instance, which is a different issue. But okay, who's valuing all the stuff for which there is no market, and that goes to other private funds as well? Because then also, what about side arrangements? If there are side letters which give investors certain advantages over other investors, then you're going to have to report that. You have to disclose your trading practices, as an advisor normally would have to do under the current ADVs. And then the commission will have to consult with its sister agencies on how to assess systemic risk and mandate disclosure of the factors that they believe will raise the questions of systemic risk. Now
these reports go to the SEC. They're not public reports. Am I correct?
That's right. And how the SEC is going to monitor this? They can't be in a position of having this pile of reports there and not having the ability to go through it. So
I don't know why not, Mike. They've done it for years, not looked at reports that were filed.
Well, in the current atmosphere, and given what happened, and given, for instance, the Enron business and WorldCom and so on, they had the Madoff affair. If you have the information, you're going to be liable for acting on it, especially if it involves a lot of money. And I think the commission has already said, Chairman Shapiro has indicated, and I think the commission has indicated, that they are going to have to hire X hundred more people to deal with this and to use electronic surveillance of these numbers, or going over this with computer programs to take a look at, well, okay, are there side letters? Okay, let's look at the side letters. There are certain items which will be red flagged and said, if it goes over a certain parameter, then then the staff is going to look at it. But it's an enormous job, and there are bound to be glitches in this. But I think the point of this is basically that here are the specific areas which the reports filed with the commission, registered or unregistered, will be required. And, of course, since these are filings with the commission, the anti-fraud provision apply to them. Now, let's see, the confidentiality of the records, I think Dick has already spoken about. And I think the proprietary trading activities, which Dick discussed, become very important.
Interestingly, everybody seems to think that the SEC will concentrate its administration, implementation, and enforcement efforts on hedge funds. But what about private equity funds?
Go ahead.
Do you think that the commission will be significantly looking at the activities of private equity funds?
In what areas? Well, first of all, the commission has already made it clear, and the Galleon case is a example of that, that they're going to be dealing with insider trading. Now, the insider trading provisions and the things that are done that are frauds on the market, whether it's done by a private equity fund or a hedge fund.
But private equity funds basically deal in non-traded securities. They buy 100% of a company.
Well, not all of them buy 100% of it. As we said, some of them now do it in stages, and there is a blurry line. If they buy 100%, there are the anti-fraud exemptions, the people that are bought out, or the people that are on either side of the transaction still have 10B. 10B applies to non-public companies.
Sure.
They apply to individual trades.
You think that the commission will focus under the new legislation more on the activities of private equity funds in terms of what representations they make to shareholders of those funds?
Yes, I think so. I think every indication is that the psychology of the enforcement people is clearly changed, that the Madoff affair didn't really have very much to do with any new fangled securities. It had to do with a Ponzi scheme, which is one of the older kinds of fraud. And front-running is an old issue, and so is insider trading. But all of these issues apply whenever you have significant trading, and the more obscure the numbers are, the more complicated the transaction and the kind of stock or interest that you're trading, the more opportunity there is for fraud, as we have learned in recent years. And I don't know, I think it would be foolish to believe that the commission isn't going to look at this, because the chances of something bad happening in terms of fraud are present in both of these areas.
Yeah, interestingly.
You agree with that?
Yes, but with a qualification. And maybe this is sort of a wrap-up point in our discussion. Historically, and you look at the Investment Advisors Act, and it's focused on protection of investment advisory clients. The justification for including hedge funds and for private equity funds had very little to do with protecting the investors in the funds themselves. They're largely big institutional investors. They have a lot to do, however, with getting examination authority over to look into the operation of those funds with a view towards protecting the markets against abuses by hedge funds and perhaps private equity funds.
I think the SEC may be focusing
more on market abuse than investor abuse insofar as investors
I think those things are connected. First of all, yes, there are institutions that are allegedly sophisticated that turn out to be not very sophisticated at all. I mean, if you take a look at some of the things that happen with state pension funds, with CalPERS, with some of the other state funds, New York, Oregon, then the losses that were incurred, other corporate pension funds were allegedly sophisticated, and in effect, they really didn't understand what the heck they were buying.
So you think that the SEC is going to commence a new stage in its operations where it will focus on protecting institutional investors from themselves?
Well, I think they've said so.
Okay.
The fact that the investor is, it may be more difficult. The question is whether or not under the fraud rules, and we should point out that non-scienter fraud applies, that the commission has non-scienter fraud authority under 17, and it has under the Advisors Act, whether the advisor is registered or not.
I think you're pointing out, Mike, that we're opening up what might be a new and interesting chapter in securities regulation. It's going to be very interesting to watch the SEC administer this legislation, and I'm sure that this is only the first of a number of discussions we will be having over the years as the legislation gets implemented as applied to private funds and in other areas.
Now, this will be the grist. This will be the grist for conferences, podcasts,
right,
and interpretations for a long time.
Yes. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Dick.
Thank you for listening to the LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier, Incorporated. Visit the LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community and all our communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. LexisNexis, Total Practice Solutions.